This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Take me out to the ball game.
What are you doing?
Did you know DirecTV has the most MLB games?
So you're singing?
Yeah, they put your favorite teams front and center right when you turn it on. Buy me some cold cuts and flapjacks.
Those aren't even the words.
I'm allergic to peanuts.
Stream DirecTV, home of the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks. RSNs available with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Welcome back, folks. Egypt presented the Arab plan that some have described as an alternative to the Trump plan. The presentation took place at an emergency Arab League summit. The plan was immediately rejected by Israel and unfavorably looked upon by the United States. And meanwhile, the ceasefire and the peace process seems to be stalled. Here to talk to us about it is Bruce Gentleson, William Preston Few, Distinguished Professor of Public Policy, Professor of Political Science, Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Bruce, I guess that's a fair characterization that this Arab plan was put together as an alternative to what Trump was talking about.
Yeah, I mean, planning by the Arab countries had been in the works throughout this conflict that goes back to the Hamas terrorist acts against Israel on October 7, 2023. And when President Trump came up with his, plan to turn Gaza into a resort and, force all the Palestinians to leave, it put a little more pressure on them to get specific. And they actually issued their own 91-page glossy brochure about what theirs would look like. And it differs significantly from the Trump plan. And it's not a surprise that Israel's rejected it and the United States has pretty much rejected it as well. But it does reflect, a number of Arab countries coming together about what they're prepared to do.
Obviously, one of the things, as I was looking at both the Trump plan and the Arab plan, because of our experience in the aftermath of Katrina here, when we talk about how many homes were flooded, they were not completely destroyed, like the 90% of the homes, as some are saying. I think the UN says that 90% of the homes in Gaza are destroyed or damaged. A much more realistic timeline under the Trump plan than this Arab plan that seems to be really short in duration that they're pulling all of this together. Your thoughts?
Well, I think the big difference is, and I say this as someone whose wife was born in the Lower Ninth and still has cousins in New Orleans and, who left after Katrina and came back. That was an act of nature, Katrina. Gaza has been destroyed by a war. And the notion that the Trump plan is the most unrealistic notion that's around, which is you're going to force all the Palestinians to leave Gaza. You're right. There's a lot of rubble. There's more rubble there than homes. But, when you see the video, these people going back from the southern part to the northern part, older people, women and children, it'd be as if people told people in New Orleans after Katrina, it's not up to you. You can't go back, right? We're making the decision for you. And in this case, it's not even, their own leader making the decision, but somehow the president of the United States. So the most unrealistic part of all of this, and I think the really problematic part, is the whole Trump plan, which is very different than what's been tried for a long time and needs to continue to be tried, which is to figure out, you know, how you get to a two-state solution and you have peace and security for Palestinians and Israelis.
The interesting thing, though, is that in neither plan do they really talk about, well, how do you rebuild this if people are actually trying to live in this rubble?
So, you know, the Arab plan talks
about... Where do they go?
Yeah, no, the Arab plan talks about keeping them in Gaza and building temporary shelters, you know, whether they're buildings or, you know, there's a lot of experience in this. I mean, there are, you know, camps all over the world for refugees, not just in the Middle East, but in Africa and Asia. There are NGOs and companies that build these kind of shelters. It can be done. And I think the figure on the Arab plan was probably $53 billion. My guess is it probably cost close to double than that. But these are countries that have quite a bit of money, Saudi Arabia included, and the United Arab Emirates, big oil producers. And it's in their interest that this conflict get to a point where there's a degree of stability. And they want to have relations with Israel, but they also don't want to abandon the Palestinian people. So, you know, there's has some flaws. But the starting point for the Trump plan of, you know, forcing everybody to leave makes it a total non-starter.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that by any stretch of the imagination. Kind of curious, though, this two-state solution, the Arab plan seems to ignore a lot of the historic friction that has existed here and what ultimately is going to happen with the multiple factions of Palestinians that are there, more importantly, Hamas, and how they continue to deal with that or deal with the PA or to deal with other Palestinian factions.
Yeah, you're definitely right about Hamas. They kind of talk around that because they don't have a solution for that. I actually was involved when I was serving in the Clinton administration on one of the Middle East, you know, negotiating teams for the U.S. and have stayed involved in these issues, not just as a professor, but in a lot of other ways over the last 30 years. And, you know, the achieving a two-state solution was hard back in the 1990s. It was hard after 9/11, and it's even harder now. But there's nothing else that carries the word solution, either for the Israelis or the Palestinians. You know, you have, for example, the former head of the Shin Bet, the Israeli, you know, one of the top Israeli intelligence services and covert actions, you know, who said just the last couple of months that the only way for Israel to be secure is if we achieve peace with the Palestinians, full stop. And so this is not some, you know, flower-carrying peacenik. This is a guy, pretty hard-headed person. And so the question becomes, you know, not if but how, which is a really hard question. But that's where the focus needs to be. And when we divert the focus to all these other kind of crazy ideas, you make a difficult thing even harder.
Yeah, and I guess for me, kind of not being that informed on the inside of this, is that when the other day the Palestinian groups of Palestinians come out and they articulated a position that they're in full support of Hamas, and you know, as they're sitting there among this rubble and not knowing what their future holds, how do you convince folks that, you know, they actually need to get along with Israel?
You know, I actually think that that's a bit more doable than that. It's really interesting. In the summer of 2023, so before the war, there was a pretty credible survey done by actually a Palestinian-American professor. And the results of this showed 62% of the Palestinians in Gaza, you know, were disaffected from Hamas. You know why? Because they're not helping their kids, they're not providing health care, they're not providing jobs. And even when, during the war, you know, you found reports from people saying, as they say, you know, talking against Hamas. So I'm not convinced that a lot of the Palestinian people hate Israel now, even more than they did before the war. But a lot of Palestinian people also really hate and resent the fact that they were made, you know, targets by Hamas, and Hamas knew exactly what it was doing. And so I think it's the problem is really with Hamas. Its support among the Palestinian people is just not that strong. And so that gives you something to work with. Palestinian Authority has had problems, corruption, but, you know, that grew out of the PLO, Yasser Arafat's group, which for decades nobody believed would ever make peace with Israel. And it started to. And the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, you know, has had problems governing. Ain't perfect, and a lot of reasons for that. But it's largely worked with Israeli and American security, you know, to try to make more security for its people, and knowing that it's got to do that in order to make progress with Israel and the United States.
The Arab plan seems to look towards the UN in some way, shape, or form. One would argue, and I think you might agree, there's not a whole lot of trust there, right, by Israel or many others.
Yeah, you know, the Israelis, you know, feel that the UN has been very anti-Israel, and they feel that with some justification. You know, I think this would ultimately take peacekeeping force, and that would have to come from the Arab countries. It's not going to come from the U.S. There might be some that come from Europe, although Europe's got its hands full now with Ukraine. Nobody's going to would ask the U.S. troops to be in that situation. And so you could put together a peacekeeping force. Sometimes, you know, these are like under U.N. auspices, and sometimes they're not. And so it would really be, I think, more of a Arab world force than a U.N. force. You know, but there has to be some sense that the U.S. and Europe would back them up, you know, not send troops, but, you know, back them up with resources and other things that would give them a better chance of succeeding.
What is the motivation for the Arab countries, though, to really enforce whatever the provisions are as it relates to the peace agreement? You know, we've tried this in southern Lebanon with Hezbollah, and obviously there wasn't much of an appetite for the UN Security Council or anyone else to actually hold them to some of the constraints that were agreed upon there. And we've seen it historically that there's been a lack of desire on the part of the Arab world to really hold anybody's feet to the fire on any of these peace provisions that we've tried to achieve.
Well, they've got two motivations, mainly. One is a lot of Arab countries kind of thought they could do an end-around strategy, you know, make, you know, peace or economic relations with Israel and not deal with the Palestinians. That was these Abraham Accords that got in the first Trump administration, and there was talk about the Saudis. And I think what they see now is that's not possible, right? It was reinforced that that wasn't possible. And secondly is, you know, they do not want Palestinian refugees coming to their countries, Jordan in particular, and Egypt. That would destabilize their country. So in both those ways, there's self-interest here. And, you know, some of the problem, again, I've, you know, been involved in this a lot. I'm very much a supporter of Israel. I have a lot of close Israeli friends and colleagues. But the Netanyahu government, not just now, but for many years, has been part of the problem. For many years, it allowed funding that wasn't supposed to go to Hamas to get into Gaza, so that Netanyahu could basically say, I can't make a peace deal, look at Hamas, even though the Palestinian Authority had some credible leaders, particularly a prime minister who was there for a number of years who was trying to fix things. So, you know, in some ways, you know, the Israeli government has been part of the problem, not just Hamas and not just the Arab countries, about the inability to have serious peace talks for a lot of years now.
But is that a byproduct of the fact that, and I find this very interesting, and I've talked about it on the show many times, nobody wants the Palestinians. I mean, that's an outcome. That's a what. And it seems like a lot of people don't want to talk about the why. Why is that?
Nobody's, you know, they're supposed to have their own country. That was the deal in 1948. Right, that there'd be an Israel and a Palestine. And so the notion of, you know, them going to Jordan or Egypt or Saudi Arabia, nobody, and the Palestinians don't want that either. And I got to tell you, there was a period in the 90s where we were actually moving the ball a lot, you know, and then Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by his own right wing. He who had won the leading general, in the 1967 war, whose famous expression was, there's no guarantee that peace with the Palestinians will bring Israel security, but there's no way Israel will be secure without peace with the Palestinians. And he started working with Arafat, who he hated and tried, to get for many years.
And Arafat actually ended up walking from the table, right?
Well, that was after Rabin was killed. That was in 2000 there. But the loss of Rabin was a really big thing because he had the credibility, sort of like when we used to say Nixon went to China because he had a reputation as anti-communist. He had an ability that his successors didn't have of being credible as a military guy who was convinced, that peace was not an act of concession, but was an act of Israeli security. And then 5 years later, when Clinton was trying to strike a deal at the end of the Clinton administration, a little bit on both sides, but you're right, basically Arafat walked away at that point.
So where do you think this goes now? I, for one, am not really sure that Trump was really serious about what he put forward. I think he was trying to stimulate a conversation, stimulate thought. I don't think he really wants to get wrapped up any more so in the Middle East than he does of what he's indicated relative to Ukraine. I may be fundamentally wrong, because I agree with you. A lot of what he put in that plan, it to me is pie in the sky. It's never going to work. But it certainly caused a reaction, if nothing else, right?
We say that a lot about him. We said it in his first term, that he's trying to shake things up, be outside the box and all that sort of thing. And there can be some virtue to that, right? You make people get serious about things. The problem here, is that it has emboldened those in the current Israeli government who want to annex Gaza and West Bank. And they've been saying, right on, and there's not as much attention being paid to what's happening in the West Bank. And there's some violence coming out of the Palestinian refugee camps there. But I was talking recently to a friend and colleague in Israeli who's a retired brigadier general and who lives near the, in areas, Israeli areas in the West Bank. And he said, he and his wife are going out to harvest the olives because the Palestinians can't get to their fields, right? And he's saying that as an Israeli who says, we're making the problem here worse. So whatever shaking up the Trump idea did, you can put that in the positive column. But in the negative column, it's made the Israelis even harder line in ways that are endangering the lives of the hostages that are still alive. Changing the dialogue from how do we come to a deal to when do we get started with annexation. And I think that's really dangerous.
Yeah. So, the next step, too, relative to this ceasefire and peace process, we put the red line out there, right? Release the hostages or, hell will be brought upon you or whatever it was that they said. Well, Hamas, I think, yesterday or maybe this morning said we're sticking to the original deal whether you like it or not, and we're moving forward with the original deal. So now what? I mean,
yeah, he said that about two Saturdays ago, and that was a very Trumpian statement. The deal was, and here I'll give some credit, before the Trump inauguration, the Biden people and the Trump people were actually working together. The Biden people were working on the negotiations of the terms of the ceasefire. And Trump's, envoy went to Netanyahu and said, Trump wants you to make a deal, right? So you actually had them, for one of the few times actually working together in a way that was constructive. It's a three-phase deal. We were supposed to we're pretty much through the first 6 weeks of the deal, which was a certain number of hostages every week, certain number of Palestinian prisoners. But we were supposed to have started negotiations on the second phase. And because of this, you know, Mar-a-Gaza stuff, that hasn't started on either side, right? And there's no need for, you know, Trump would be serving it better if he said, guys, get serious, both of you, about phase two of the deal. That would be like he really wants to help, as opposed to he wants just to sort of, you know, get attention to himself and blow things up.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see what the next step is going to be and what the reaction is when they double down like that. Is that, you know, you cannot throw threats out there and not back it up, because then you lose credibility, right? I mean,
right.
It's gone.
Kind of like the boy that cried wolf, you know. And
yeah, exactly.
You've seen that
exactly.
In other areas, tariffs and all that sort of stuff. And so, and, you know, it's like, you know, diplomacy can move really slowly, but, you know, throwing a hand grenade into the middle of it more often than not makes it move even slower or go backwards.
Yeah. No doubt. Bruce Gentleson, thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate your time and your insight, and we would love to check back with you as this progresses, and I'm afraid maybe become more complex in nature, so we may need more assistance in trying to understand what's going on for certain.
All right, well, thanks for having me. Take care.
Thank you so much. That's Bruce Gentleson, William Preston Few, Distinguished Professor of Public Policy, Professor of Political Science, Sanford School of Public Policy, and the Duke University. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Equinor Jewelers Talk and text line. Stay with us.
Say yes to Pure Leaf Tea and free gas for a year only at True North Convenience Stores. When it comes to quality, say yes to the delicious taste of real brewed Pure Leaf Tea. True North stores are stocked with your favorite flavors like unsweetened, extra sweet, and raspberry. For a limited time, enter for a chance to win free gas for a year. Check the True Rewards app for details or download the mobile app from the Apple or Google Play stores. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, folks, the DOGE team under the Trump administration has focused on bureaucratic giveaways, and we've talked about this, and in many cases have seriously impacted non-governmental organizations, and in some cases, rightfully so, But there are other business organizations that are the beneficiaries of handouts that probably should be examined as well through the lens of wasteful spending. The Cato Institute published a study about corporate welfare, and the author of same joins us, Chris Edwards, a policy scholar at the Cato. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
So, Chris, not a lot of discussion by Republicans or others relative to corporate welfare. What did your study reveal?
Well, I scoured the giant federal budget, which is a giant foot-high stack of documents on my desk, and found $181 billion a year in business subsidies or corporate welfare. This is everything from subsidies to big farm corporations, to subsidies to semiconductor companies, broadband companies, automobile companies, energy companies. I think this is the first place that Republicans in Congress and the administration should look to cut. I think, you know, the DOGE effort is trying to pare back the bureaucracy, and that's okay. And the Republicans have this so-called reconciliation bill coming up where they're going to trim Medicaid, and that's okay. But an even higher priority, I think, is cutting business subsidies. I think that's something that both, you know, liberals and conservatives should be able to get behind. These business subsidies, I think, are damaging to the economy, and we simply can't afford them with our giant deficits.
Now, in the study, you outlined 10 areas that we should actually be concerned about relative to these subsidies. Sometimes these subsidies are like ongoing. They never go away, right? I mean, it's almost as though when these areas get onto public
that's it.
They stay on it forever.
You know, we the federal government started business subsidies, believe it or not, way back in 1795 when the federal government started subsidizing the fur trading industry, believe it or not. Then in the 19th century, we had railroad subsidies. So the government has always subsidized businesses to some extent, but those subsidies often got a lot of criticism and were virtually all repealed within a few years. The problem in recent decades is that the federal government keeps adding new business subsidy programs, and they never go away. They never go back and look to see how well these subsidies are working or not working and repeal, you know, the harmful ones. So that's what I'm calling for here. You know, Congress should examine these programs and recognize that a lot of these programs sort of create collateral damage. They're complex. There, a lot of them are just sort of a complex mess. The high paid lawyers, you know, benefit, but not really, you know, the average American people.
And a lot of the companies recently, especially in the area of wind, correct me if I'm wrong, they themselves have said that they can't make it without the subsidies. They wouldn't be engaged in developing these wind fields off the East Coast if they didn't have the subsidies. And a lot of the contracts have been canceled and they've moved on because the subsidies have dissipated. True or not?
Well, a lot of those wind companies are finding that even with the subsidies, the offshore doesn't make much sense. I mean, if you have to subsidize the business for companies to earn earn profits, it seems to me it's not a very sensible business that we ought to be doing in the economy anyway. But, you know, one of the problems with these subsidies is they divorce businesses from the actual needs of consumers. And I think a really good example of this is the massive subsidies for electric vehicles. Ford Motor Company, you may have noticed, has been losing billions of dollars over the last year, even despite the EV subsidies. They're losing massive amounts of money on the EVs. It sort of tells you that Ford got divorced from its consumers. And, you know, while some consumers are going to EVs, the subsidies induce Ford to put too much investment in these high-cost EVs and ignore consumers who don't want those vehicles.
Yeah, do you believe that there's an appetite to look at these subsidies?
Well, some of them. I mean, so President Biden, my study looked at the spending subsidies. There's about $180 billion a year in spending subsidies for businesses. But President Biden put in place about $100 billion a year in narrow tax loopholes for energy businesses. You mentioned wind businesses, also solar and battery and EV makers. These folks all have all these narrow tax breaks. It was just far too much. It was just massive overkill on these tax credit subsidies. So Republicans, I think, are going to try to pare back those subsidies in the upcoming tax bill that they want to push through Congress.
Not as broad as that W-2 employee tax subsidy, right? where you've got nothing.
We'll see. Trump wants to add his own sort of special tax loopholes, which I think are a bad idea. I think the idea ought to be getting out both the Republican and Democratic loopholes from the tax code and just having a simpler flat tax.
Yeah, I mean, I think
that's
there.
A whole
I think
different
there's.
Topic.
Yeah, it is, but I think there's a strong appetite to think about that. That a lot of folks would rather it be a lot more simplified in so many different ways. When we look at the regulatory side of these, you mentioned it earlier. We don't police these things very well, right? We don't really look at whether or not we're getting a significant return on our investment.
No, exactly right. And there's, to give you one specific example, the federal tax code has this item called low-income housing tax credit. It's about $12 billion a year that goes to developers to develop low-income housing. The reality of this credit, if you look into the details, is that the low-income tenants don't really benefit from this. It's the middlemen who benefit, the banks and the developers, who get the benefits of these credits. And there's a lot of fraud and abuse in these low-income housing credits. And the Government Accountability Office has essentially reported that this credit is so complex that the IRS doesn't have the resources to properly audit it. So this is an example where Congress has created a tax credit supposedly to help low-income folks. It doesn't. And it's so complex that there's a lot of fraud and abuse that is beyond the ability of the IRS to police it. So this is the exact type of wasteful credit we ought to be getting out of the tax code.
Any others that come to mind that the listening audience may have heard stories being reported about?
Well, I mean, there's always farm subsidies, which is the single biggest business subsidy program. There's over $40 billion a year now of federal spending for subsidy programs for farmers. The government helps farmers with, their insurance costs, with marketing costs, with the research costs, just a vast amount of subsidies for that one industry that, other industries are not as coddled as farming. And the vast majority of those farm subsidies don't go to the small farmers. They go to the big giant farming corporations. In fact, the statistic on that is that if you look at the biggest farm subsidy programs, 60% of the benefits go to the 10% biggest farms. So, this doesn't make any sense. It's not helping the average small farmer, and we simply can't afford that sort of largesse anymore.
And we hear about that all the time, stories being reported of the family farm just, disappearing from the landscape in America.
Part of what's going on is that all these subsidies go to the big farm corporations, so that they're pumped up with money, and they're able to go out and buy up the farmland, so that raises farmland prices, and that makes it harder for small farmers to get into farming. So these, ultimately the beneficiaries are the big landowners, and there's actually a lot of billionaires who own a lot of farmland. So a lot of these farm subsidies essentially end up in the pockets of billionaires, which is really an absurd kind of a program.
It's been reported in Louisiana that Bill Gates and others have the largest landowners, farm landowners in the state of Louisiana. And I've always kind of looked at it and wondered why are they doing that?
Exactly. Well, I guess it's I guess it's it's a good investment, and they get the subsidies are tied to the land, so that it's the landowners that get the subsidies. There's actually interesting statistics from the Department of Agriculture that half of all farmland in America is not farmed by the owners. There's tenant farmers. So half of the farms in America, these subsidies, they go to the landowners who are different people than the actual farmers who farm the land.
Well, how do we correct this? I mean, obviously these things, they're one of the largest lobbying groups in America that are up there making sure that this continues on, and it increases almost every year.
I agree. It's a huge problem, and it's the farm subsidies are bipartisan. I think the way to do it, I think with a lot of these subsidy programs, is to start cutting the high earners off the subsidies. This is true of something as the biggest federal program, Social Security. We simply can't afford anymore to provide Social Security benefits to people like you mentioned, Bill Gates or Elon Musk or other people. The program, the Social Security program, has a massive trust fund shortfall. The program's going bankrupt. Well, let's at least start cutting wealthy people off the program. That's true of Social Security, some of these other entitlement programs like Medicare and farm subsidies. That's where we ought to start cutting. And I think those sorts of cuts will be perceived to be the most fair way to start balancing the federal budget.
Chris Edwards, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon on a Friday. We really appreciate your time and your insight. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. That's Chris Edwards, policy scholar at the Cato Institute. They just published a study on this, and he outlines 10 different areas where this is really a problem. Very interesting read. You can find that at their website, which I think is cato.org, if my memory serves me correct. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Let's go to the talk lines. Chuck, you're up. What say you?
Yeah, Noel, if we just enforce the current tax laws, which is never done, and just the tax collection, but there was a law that was put into effect, I don't know, 10 years ago called the Net Investment Income Tax. Mm-hmm. It was a 3.8% tax that was added to investment income like interest, dividends, capital gains, and the very wealthy, it was aimed at them, and it was going to help fund Medicare. It was going to make a serious dent in the problems we have with the Medicare funding. Most of these rich people either aren't paying it by their own volition and no one's checking it, or they're doing tax advantage vehicles like they always do to sidestep it. Just like when Trump passed the $10,000 limit on taxes being able to deduct it on your itemized deductions. Well, the businesses did another little loophole. Yeah, the pass-through entity, they let the companies deduct the tax instead of the individual, so they sidestepped it. They keep sidestepping everything. That's why there's no money. And that's why I've said this before. We can't just allow the very wealthy to monitor themselves. They're never going to do it. And that's why we're in trouble. And that's why there's new billionaires being created every year. And I'm an accountant, and I know that if you got one side of the ledger that's growing, and to create billionaires, that means you've got to make a lot of people poor to create new billionaires. So the gap,
Chuck,
is growing.
When did we, I guess, the adoption of the tax code, have we always been really about this tax avoidance scheme? I mean, look, everybody takes advantage of every single loophole they can find. You obviously are in the business of this. A lot of this is craftily worded, and I think there's some intentionality as it relates to loopholes when they pass these bills. Your thoughts?
Well, absolutely. That's why they have wealthy tax attorneys, because they make this language so difficult to understand. Nobody can police it. Let me tell you something. I've worked with government employees. They don't understand the law at all. So a good CPA, a good tax attorney goes in there and says, da, 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 and they don't even know how to audit these things. So they don't even go after them because they don't have the personnel's expertise to do it. Yes, it's designed to be that way for sure. And why do you think? Because they have the lobbyists in Congress to make it designed that way where they can sidestep it all the time.
Yeah, and then we wonder why we can't finance what so much of our folks in this country have grown accustomed to. And before everybody goes crazy on the text line, Social Security being one of them. You know, I mean, Social Security for my parents was huge. They didn't have a lot of money in their life, and they you know, relied on Social Security to be able to survive in many respects. So it's kind of interesting the way that people view things. All right, thank you so much for the call. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we will visit with Jill Dennis, director, owner of the Assured Supervision Accountability Program. We'll talk about electronic monitoring, some of the legislation that will be proposed in this legislative session. And in the back half of the next hour, we'll visit with Bernie Pinsenot, political analyst, and we'll find out what the public believes about Trump's State of the Union address on Wednesday.
Nerds.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Life comes with big money questions. Are target date funds a smart or lazy way to invest? Should you pay off debt or invest extra cash? Can you deduct your dog as a home security system on your taxes? NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast has the answers. Their finance journalists break down investing strategies, tax planning, and smart ways to build wealth and navigate big financial decisions. Work smarter, not harder, on your finances this year. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
StreetEasy knows former New Yorkers never stop talking about how much they miss living in NYC.
Life used to feel like a movie, but since we left and bought a house, it's like living in a DIY home repair video.
When it's time to buy, let StreetEasy connect you with the right agent you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. StreetEasy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Ugh, your clothes are too tight, yet you can't lose weight, even though you've tried so many diets. The reason you're having trouble losing weight could be a liver clogged with fat, and that is slowing your metabolism. Introducing Omicid, a natural superfood protein shake that uses natural amino acids and bioactive peptides to help unclog your liver and optimize your metabolism so it's easier to lose weight, and it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Find out more and see the university studies at omicid.com. That's AlmaSed.com.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a five-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. Five-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
The PGA Tour is all systems go, and so is the new show, Early Wedge, on the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Sportsline experts Sia Nejad, Mike McClure, and Eric Cohen alongside myself, Rick Gaiman, Patrick McDonald, and Jason Sobel. Five times per week, the Early Wedge provides the best information for DFS lineups, outright selections, and so much more. Follow and listen to Early Wedge in the Early Edge feed on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.